I'm sure everyone has said this to you already, but welcome to Oxford, welcome to the English faculty. Well done for getting here. It's the finest English faculty in the world, I can say that without dispute. And congratulations, above all, for working out that if you're going to do a course in English language and literature, it's quite sensible in your first week to come to where it all starts. And what I'm going to be taking through in these lecture series is the beginning of English literature, the beginning of the English language, and try and make it as reasonably entertaining as possible. So today's lecture is Introduction to Old English, who, where, what, when, why bother, as in why would you want to bother to study Old English, and not necessarily in that order, I can't remember. But anyway, so let us start with some Old English. Hwat we gardene in yardagum theod kuninga thrim ye frunon hu the other lingas ellen fremedon. Now that may look like a nightmare to you. You're thinking, what on earth is that? That is Old English. That is the English that people, your ancestors possibly, were speaking about 1,000 years ago. For the record, it's the opening three lines of a poem called Beowulf. And I think it was in Annie Hall, Woody Allen said, whatever you do, don't do a course where they make you read Beowulf. So obviously you've never seen that film. But anyway, that is the start of the epic 3,000 lines. Now, I'm not expecting you to translate that or to understand what's going on there. We'll work through that. So the aims of this lecture series, give you a bit of basics about Old English, the language, literature, and the culture. If you are going on to do Paper 3A, Mods Paper 3A, which is Old English, then this is kind of a bit of a preparation. Above all, this may sound like an impossible task, but it's to promote an enjoyment of Old English and to kind of force you to start thinking about why it is an incredibly important subject and an important period in English literature. Those are the lectures. Old English language next week, Old English poetry, Old English prose, Old English films. You may think the Anglo-Saxons didn't make many films, but I'm here to put you straight on that matter. As you can see, I don't put much imagination into my lecture titles. I put them all into the content. And it is all on the web. Well, not. I mean, it's kind of all on the web. So if you didn't get a handout, don't worry. But there is a screenshot there of WebLearn, as it's called, which is the virtual learning environment. Anyway, it's a website where I will be putting all the handouts, course material, slides, audio recordings, possibly, of the lectures. And also, there's all kinds of things going on there. I had great fun over the summer, as you can see, looking at Facebook and Twitter and all kinds of things. So it's all there. It's a kind of a site for Anglo-Saxon studies, Old English studies, while you're in Oxford, and you log in, da-da-da-da-da, follow those instructions, okay? But I'll send a note around the faculty mailing list so that you at least know what I'm talking about, and you can just follow the link. Right, we're going to start with an icebreaker. It's your first week in Oxford, maybe your second week in Oxford. You probably don't know many people here already. You don't know the person sitting next to you, so you're about to learn who they are. So what I want you to do over the next couple of minutes is just turn to the person to your left or right or wherever and just discuss this question. What does the term Anglo-Saxon mean to you? And then we'll have a shout-out bit. Go. All right, that'll do. And you're very talkative. Previous years, they all sit here and stare at me. We don't know. Well done. Okay, so what did we get? What did the term Anglo-Saxon mean to you or nowadays, whatever? English Saxons. It's actually, yeah, that's kind of a nice twist on the Anglo-Saxon, English-Saxon. I like that. Absolutely. But we're not in the interview now. You're at Oxford. What does the term Anglo-Saxon mean today? I mean, if you went out in the street there and grabbed someone legally, that is, and said, what does the Anglo-Saxon mean to you? What would you think they'd say? Beards and helmets. Okay, old. Beowulf. Beowulf, do you really think? So you don't go to the same pubs I do. But anyway, all right. Well, actually, that's interesting, because normally people say swear words or something like that. And Google, huh, where would we be without Google? Google Alerts is quite funny. If you type in Anglo-Saxon, this is the sort of thing you get. So what have we got here? The Anglo-Saxon model of governance. I've no idea what that is. The Supreme Court, the last redoubt of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. There's a bit about Freddie Flintoff here using Anglo-Saxon words. To one of his colleagues. It's only really you get an ear, you get anything approaching what we're going to be talking about. And that's because the term is slightly misused. If you go on YouTube and type in Anglo-Saxon, as well as getting a few clips of meaningful stuff, you get this strange bloke in his bedroom with a guitar singing songs about right-wing nationalism, because there is this notion that the Anglo-Saxons, and some it's complete bonkers, as we will go on to in a second, that it's something to do with extreme right-wing thoughts, etc. So be careful. And it is a phrase which is bandied about. I think the French talk about the Anglo-Saxons, the Anglo-Saxon business model and things like that. I mean, I have no idea what they're referring to. But we don't want to be talking about that. Now, of course, it came into the news. How I scripted this a couple of weeks ago. The Staffordshire Horde, where some bloke near Lichfield with his metal detector unearthed probably the same amount of the combined amount of treasure we have from the Anglo-Saxon period in one dig. I used to live in Staffordshire. It's really frustrating. So that was really good, because then you got a lot of articles spawning these things. Discussion about Anglo-Saxon. Oh, that's actually quite nice treasure. Maybe these people weren't a bunch of barbarians with beards and helmets sitting in huts, hitting each other over the head with an axe. They might have had something about them. And that's really the first lesson of today, is that we are talking about a really civilised period, and that's what I'm going to try and expose you and introduce you through the literature. So, some professional terminology in your first week. There are various phrases which are bandied about. First of all, Old English, as I used it in the title. We tend to use Old English to refer to the language and literature, but not the historical period. We don't talk about the Old English people. Medieval is an all-encompassing term, and it really, to take a rough idea, stretches from around the 5th century up to possibly the beginning of the 16th century. But again, you might be looking at medieval language, medieval literature, the medieval historical period. Medieval people, well, medieval man, medieval woman, is a really bad phrase to use, because you're talking about 1,000 years, they slightly differed from the beginning and the end of the period. Anglo-Saxon pretty much means everything. You can talk about the Anglo-Saxons, the Anglo-Saxon period. You are here to learn Anglo-Saxon, you're going to read Anglo-Saxon literature. But in this faculty, we tend to favour Old English, because it shows that what you're doing here is part of the English syllabus. Now, the phrase that everyone uses or did use is the Dark Ages. This is a no-no. This is verboten. It basically means it's referring to the early period. I'll talk about the dates in a second, when there wasn't much known about it. But what it generally people use, it throw out, oh, they were the Dark Ages. Nothing happened in those times. You know, there was the Romans disappeared, and then the Normans came along, and they were so nice and really polite and everything like that. It was just in the middle, and there was these bunch of savages who no one could understand. Don't use the Dark Ages. So let's define Old English. Old English is a term used to refer to the language and literature spoken and written in England, whatever that is, during the rule of the Anglo-Saxons, 450 up to the mid-11th century. So I want to see that in every essay that you now put out to your tutors, okay? And the questions I'm going to cover in this lecture, when, what period of history are we really talking about? I've given some indication there. Who were the Anglo-Saxons? Where did they come from? Where did they go to? What's Old English? And why on earth is any of this important to you? Or, as the Saxons would have put, quana, qua, quer, quat, and hui, which hopefully indicates to you that there's some similarities here in the language. You may notice a pattern there, that in modern English we have just reversed the W and the H on those words, and that really came in the Middle English period, when the scribes, who thought, what on earth is all this, swapped the letters around. But actually, if you say the word, why, you tend to say the H before the W. So the Saxons had it right. So let's talk about when. When are we really talking about? So I'm going to show you a clip of film. There's lots of film clips in these lectures. And I want you to think, and you can talk to that person next to you, what is right with this film? If we did what is wrong with it, well, anyway, you'll see what I mean. There's a lot happening. So think about what's right and what's wrong. That's Kirk Douglas, by the way. That's Tony Curtis. All right, what was wrong with that then? Apart from the acting. Yes. No, they didn't have castles. It's only in the 9th century. Castles are generally a period of post-conquest. Although, I have to say that, there is a theory that some of the stone works in Oxford Castle, the foundations are Anglo-Saxon, but we do have stone buildings from the Anglo-Saxon period. Go down Cornmarket Street, face Kentucky Fried Chicken, turn around, and there's an Anglo-Saxon stone building for you. What else? Chainmail. They did have chainmail, yes. Yeah, maybe not as much as that, but they did have chainmail, yes? No, that's it. You're right, yes. Tactically, they were slightly better off than that. Although, actually, the formation, the shield formation is probably there. Okay, one more. Well, they didn't throw axes at drawbridges because there weren't any drawbridges to throw. You're quite right. They did throw axes. So it was a throwing weapon. But, yeah, so the usual thing is archery. Did they have the longbows? No, they didn't, and so on. The point is that if you go and watch films about this period from Hollywood, you're going to get this idea. Castles, people running around, people in distress. Vikings usually are the good, hard guys. The Saxons are the people who hide behind things. This is, of course, nonsense. So, when are we talking about? Mid-5th century, as I said, Bede, the Venerable Bede, says that the Saxons came over in 449, the Anglo-Saxons. He publishes his book in the early 8th century. And we're going up to what is normally called October 14th, 1066, which is the date of the Battle of Hastings. Now, that date is, of course, nonsense, because that does not mean on October the 15th everyone woke up and wasn't an Anglo-Saxon. They were quite happy. They were the same people. In fact, Anglo-Saxons ruled up to Christmas and never gave the Normans a bit of peace. But if you think about that, if I can find some chalk, there's a chalk mountain here. Let's tell the EC. There's a chalk mountain, that didn't work. Right, if we do a chronological, let's say to the year 2000, the year 1000, and the year dot. So we're over here. We're talking about that amount of period of English language, English literature, English history. No problem in 5 lectures. So if you're doing Victorian novel, you've got a little bit bitty here. You've got lots more, because there's not much coming from this, but that is the balance. We're talking about a long period of history. And this is a clip from a TV programme. It's on Channel 4. I don't know if you saw it. I'll start it. It was called 1066, The Battle for Middle-earth. I'll tell you why it was called The Battle of Middle-earth later on, but anyway. So this is a bit more what we're thinking of in terms of the type of settlements, the type of environment that people were in. Anyway, it's a wedding. They're getting married. It's not a nice story because obviously they then go off to fight the Battle of Hastings, which doesn't end too well. Anyway, it's a reasonably accurate wedding ceremony, and you're hearing Old English there. No priest, because the church didn't really care about weddings, didn't have anything to do with them until much later. But anyway, that's the type of culture we're looking at, not castles with dragons and people, etc., and damsels in distress. A word of warning. I have to put this in because it does come up again and again. You may instantly be thinking of Thor, Odin, Frigg, Loki, sagas, Vikings, boats, horned helmets. I'll give you the boats, I'll give you the Vikings, but that isn't Old English. That's what we call Old Norse. So that is the language and literature and culture of the people who predominantly were living in Norway, Denmark and Iceland. Although, of course, this impacts on the Anglo-Saxons in many ways. This is not Old English what we're talking about there, although there is an overlap, as we will see later. And the interesting thing, which people forget, is that all of this mythology about the Vikings, this Old Norse mythology, isn't written down until the 13th century. So that's going, it's talking about things happened 400 or 500 years before, whereas in Old English, you're getting stuff written down in the vernacular, in English, from the period. Okay, I don't know what we're up to who now. In any case, who were they? Someone quite rightly said Anglo-Saxon Jutes, which is the traditional list of these 3 tribes who came over and settled what we call mainland Britain. But it was many, many others, Franks, Huns, etc. Where did they go to? I'll show you some maps. The Angles tend to settle in the north and the Midlands of England, this is. The Saxons southwest and around Essex. The Jutes, the poor little Jutes, in Kent and the Isle of Wight. And this is where they came from. There they are. Coming over the North Sea and the English Channel. So they're coming from this area here, Denmark, northern Germany. I'll talk a bit more about this next year. This, by the way, why we call it the Age of Migration, is you can see the Germanic tribes were on the march as the Roman Empire began to crumble. But these are the people we're particularly interested in. But you can see that even if you follow the roots of some of these, the Goths, etc., we're all talking about a massive migration of people and their cultures from around this area of Europe. And that explains quite a bit. This is where our lot ended up. So you have the Angles. That's why we have East Anglia. You have the Mercian kingdoms there. You have these big kingdoms. You have the Jutes down here. And then you have the Saxons. So that's why we have East Saxons or Essex, South Saxons, Sussex, and so on. That's where they tended to settle. But they were from a very small area in northern Germany and Denmark. Now, this is, of course, very interesting culturally and topically for today, because what this basically says is 1,500 years ago, the English came over here as economic migrants. So the next time a nasty little man from the British National Party comes at your door, can you tell him this? Tell him to go and read some history and not talk the complete nonsense that they do, the horrible little swines. Now, of course, it wasn't an empty land for people just sitting around. Oh, look, hey, look, let's have mercy. There were people here before, the poor Celts. I'm Irish, I have sympathy. We were kind of pushed to the periphery, basically, so the Celts are gradually retreating, or, well, they had kingdoms already, but that's why you have the Celtic periphery, if you like, of Cornwall, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland, of course. They were occasionally called the Britonic, and there were other people lurking around called the Romano-British. These were the Romans who had intermingled with the indigenous tribes and stayed there. Now, it's very difficult. We don't know what happened to those people because whatever happened, their culture and their language really doesn't survive. The Anglo-Saxons come in and dominate. So what else did they bring, apart from their ponies? Well, they brought their society, mainly a tribal society to begin with, but eventually it becomes kingdoms. It eventually becomes, of course, one kingdom, namely the Kingdom of England, which I'll talk about in a second, which is probably the longest surviving nation state in the sense of its borders, but by definition so are Wales and Scotland in Europe. So kings, thanes, chaols, that's where we get the word churlish, these are sort of free people, and they did have slaves. They brought their religion, their legends and their stories with them, and these would have been very similar, we assume, to the Old Norse things, but we don't know much about this, and there's reasons for that later on in the history. But we do get glimpses of what possibly they really believed in those old days, pre-Christian. For example, the days of the week, Tuesday, Woden's Day, Thor's Day, Free's Day. They talk about, they had a word called craft and witchercraft. So there was obviously some form of what we might assume as magic in those days. And they have tales or mentions at least of things like elves, dwarves, dragons, trolls, giants and orcs. So all that sort of German mythology certainly would have come over with them to a certain degree. Their outlook on life, which you find in the literature, loyalty, feuds, exile, things such as transience, the transient nature of life, the passing of worldly glory, etc. They were quite a gloomy lot in that sense. And their language, which is what we're particularly interested in. So, we're dashing through this. Huana, hua, hue, huat, hui. Huat, which is my favourite word in Old English. It means what, but it also means oi. So you can just use it whenever you want. If anyone's annoying you, you go, what? And it will draw their attention, no doubt. They might think you're a giant duck, but anyway, that's by the by. What is Old English? Well, I've kind of answered this already, but particularly I'm talking about the language here. Before we do that, let's just say, why English? That's why I liked your English Saxons, Anglo-Saxons. Why do we use the term English? Well, that is the Anglo-Saxon word for English, E-N-G-L-I-S-C, which you may think is pronounced Inglisk. But if you know a simple rule, S and C in Old English is pronounced sh. So if you come across that word, it's not something to dump your rubbish in, it's something to go to sea with, a ship. English. The Celts, strangely, called everyone Saxon, so that's where we get the word Sassenach, etc., and that's what survives in. But we really, I suppose we kind of have to thank Pope Gregory the Great. If you remember the story, when he's in Rome, he sees the slaves in the market, and he says, who are they? And they said, oh, they're the Angles. And he says, oh, no, they're not Angles, they're angels, which is probably the only joke Pope Gregory ever made, but there we are. But it kind of stuck, so that's why we have Angeli or Angli or Gens Anglorum, people of the English. Bede uses this term. He was, of course, an Angle, but he talks about the whole of everyone who's living there, and he uses it generally as an all-encompassing term for the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes. Alfred the Great, who was around the late 9th century, talks about Anglekin, which is interesting because he's a Saxon, but by then there was emerging a general term for everyone living in what we would now roughly define as England, and then that becomes Anglekin or Englelond by the time of Canute. And that's why there is English and England. So, Old English fits into the story of the English language. Generally, up around to the 12th century, we have people writing down what we could roughly describe as Old English. Then we have the Middle English period, 12th to 15th, Early Modern English, and so on. So it's important to note that Old English is a continuation of English. And you may think back to those opening lines of Beowulf and you think, that's not like any English I've ever pronounced. Well, yes and no, and we'll come on to that in a second. So let's show you an example. My apologies to using in terms of the Bible here, because that may not be your religious or cultural background, but it is a text which survives through the period, so it's a very easy one to look at how language changed. So this is how, I think it's the King James Bible, "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." In the time of Middle English, which is, if you want to think, Chaucer, "Our Father that art in heavenes, hallowed be the name." And you think, well, there's some strange things going on there. We'll come on to the second. Now, towards the end of the Saxon period, the late 10th century, "Thu ura fader they e art on heovenum, si the name yehalgod." Now, there's differences. Well, we're talking about 600 years there, but there are similarities. "Ura fader they e art on heovenum, who art in heaven." The strange things which might be puzzling you are those characters there. One looks like a P with a thing above, and the other one looks like a D falling over with a little bar. I'll talk about those in a bit. They just pronounce th. So if you see, let's think. Well, if you see that, it's not p, it's the. It's the word the. If you see this, it's not something you do in a toilet, it's this. Exactly. So just when you start to get that into your head and start reading it out loud or in your mind, then you'll be able to understand it a bit more. So is it a foreign language? Well, I use these couple of examples. They're from Lacey and Danziger, book A Year 1000, and they're quite nice. The first one, Churchill's speech. The second one, Neil Armstrong's speech. And the point that they make in the book, which is a valid one, is that every word there is from Old English, with the exception of one word. Does anyone want to guess which one it is? Surrender, exactly, and that's from French. Actually, I'm not saying anything. So if a Saxon, Anglo-Saxon, was around in 1969 and somehow was watching a TV, I know we've got to make a bit of an imagination jump there, what they'd make of a TV, I don't know. And they heard "one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, or an smal stepper for a manna, and giganta leap for mankinder," they'd have understood. They wouldn't have understood how that person got to the moon, but they would have understood it. So what I'm trying to show you there, a very simple example, is that it does carry on. So, it's a commonly used fact. It's actually probably even bigger than that, and we're noticing Anglo-Saxon words appearing more and more. Most popular words in English are from Anglo-Saxon, and of course English is spoken worldwide, a lingua franca, and it is the language of the internet, or as the Saxons would have said, the world a weed a webber. So a bit of Old English poetry. Can anyone recognise any of them? Sorry? Yep. "And after Ealum thou art mean wonder weal." The Gallagher brothers, those famous Anglo-Saxon poets. Kaiser Chiefs, yes. "Eala, oh, my God, it canna hit beluven, it was never this fair away from hum." And, of course, the best band ever, "it will have been hande healden, it will have been hande." The Beatles, exactly, yes. So, there you are, look what we are, 34 minutes into the lecture and you're already translating Old English directly into Modern English. See, it's easy, 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 easy. Okay, now we've mentioned these silly little characters here, so let's have a bit of a word about the Anglo-Saxons, a bit more about writing, about the things you're going to encounter. First thing to say is when they came over, and for a long part of their history, We would define them as an oral culture. That really means that they're passing things on by word of mouth. Ideas, facts, story are passed down from generation to generation. This is opposed, of course, to a literate culture where you write things down. Now, this is quite interesting because it challenges some things which you might normally take for granted when you're studying English literature. First of all, things like sounds, names, memory, these are all elevated because you haven't got a written document to refer to. You're passing on the story. And this is not alien to us. This happens in all kinds of cultures still, where histories, where laws, where genealogies are passed down and they are remembered and then they're passed on to the next generation and so on. What it tends to mean, though, is stories can remain fixed in a certain degree. You don't add to them. You don't add. So knowledge itself is hard to accumulate. That really comes out of a literate culture. You start writing some facts down, someone reads that and goes, oh, actually, I can add to that. Whereas in an oral culture, things tend to be moved on and on. More importantly, the text, whatever that is changed. I might tell a story in my generation. I pass it to you. You tell roughly the same story, but you might change it to adapt to what you're around. So that really challenges all kinds of ideas, particularly what is an author in an oral culture? Is it me? Is it the person who then changes it? Who, where, before me? Performance, you've got to think about how this literature was performed and who the audience was. It is wrong, however, to say that they were completely illiterate. They did have some writing and some writing skills, and these are normally what we would term runes. So there is some runic inscriptions, writings in runes, the sort of thing you will see, you must be very familiar with, which they brought over. We call their runic alphabet Futhorc, which is the first six letters, which I'll show you. Rune is an odd word in Old English. It's spelt rune, R-U-N. It means secret, so rune staff or rune stave. So that might be where we get these ideas about magic, etc., being associated with the idea of runes. Although there are some references in Old English, and particularly in Old Norse, to runes having magical powers. And we do find them. I think we've got about, 70 inscriptions from the Anglo-Saxon period. There's none in the Staffordshire hoard on stones, coins, jewellery, etc. And there is this, of course, reference to casting the runes. That is the Anglo-Saxon runic alphabet, which I will come back into a second, but now for our next film clip. Casting the runes is an interesting idea. It was actually a short story by M.R. James, a great medievalist as well, but also a ghost story writer, and it became a film in the 1950s. So I'm going to show you this because, again, it's these types of ideas which we've got to get rid of, move away from our head, clear out before we approach this subject. I won't spoil the ending for you. It's worth seeing, actually, for this hilarious giant demon that appears at the end. And it does. It's a film notable because it has the line, "It's coming, it's in the trees," which was sampled by Kate Bush many, many years ago. Thank you. Bit of movie trivia for you. Anyway, I did actually freeze frame it and work out what the hell was written on this bit of paper, which is probably a bad thing because I might get the demon coming at me, or these PowerPoint slides might. Anyway, and it says that, you'll be pleased to know, so I don't think we're in any danger whatsoever. However, back on the series, runes do appear. This is an Anglo-Saxon stone cross, which is very interesting. It's up in Ruthwell in Dumfriesshire, and you can see runic inscriptions coming down here. This is from the 8th century, I think. And what's very interesting about this is these lines form a few lines of a poem which you may have heard of. If you haven't, you will do, called Dream of the Rood. So how did that text get passed on from stone carving to manuscript 300 years later? I won't answer there. Here's some more runic inscriptions. This is from the Frank's casket in the British Museum. And if you transliterate them, you get fish, F-I-S-C, and flod, fish, and the sea. And up there it says whalebone, which is whalebone. That's what the casket is made out of. And there's little pictures. This is actually a guy called Wayland the Smith, from Norse gods. Over here, there's the adoration of the Magi when the three kings give a present to Christ. So that's interesting, pagan image with Christian image. And that's where the Simpsons got Wayland Smithers from. Also mentioned Old English poems, the husband's message is basically a runic inscription talking to someone. We have the imaginatively named rune poem. I'll talk about these in some of the magic spells that still survive in the Anglo-Saxon period and often mentioned in Old Norse. And this is probably worth about tuppence now, but this is an Icelandic banknote. And there's the thorn, still surviving. The thorn and the still used in Scandinavian languages. Icelandic is probably as near as damaged you're ever going to get to what the Vikings spoke. However, runes were not sufficient. When Christianity came, and it comes in 597, you become part again of a much wider empire and things move to a literate culture. So the monks and priests, who obviously supported Christianity because they were a product of them, needed to communicate with the rest of Europe, and they couldn't have done that with runes because not anyone would have understood them apart from a few Vikings, and they didn't really care. So they adopted the alphabet, and here is the Old English alphabet, and it's pretty much the type of thing you would expect, and you will see this. This is why you can read Old English poetry and Old English books, etc. And you will note in here, there is our little P and our little D, which I will say in a second. There's a few characters missing, Q, V, and Z. They do appear in Roman inscriptions, etc., or Latin. But anyway, that's it. So, those problem characters. First of all, there's this AE, which goes together, which is called the ash, but it's just pronounced ah. So, that is the word for that. That's all you have to remember. Then we have the P with the ascender, which we call the thorn. Remember, that was a rune, and it's pronounced TH. We have the D, and that's the capital version of it, which kind of looks like a differential sign. That's called the eth. And again, it's pronounced TH, the. You may think, why did they have two different sounds for th? If you ever say the word thither, you will know that there are two different ways of pronouncing TH, and that's what we think that's coming from. They didn't use the character W, they used what we call the win, which kind of looks like a thorn, but when you're reading your text, you will see it as a W, just to make life a bit easier for you. Come on. Right. Here we have some Anglo-Saxon. In its original form, just to show I'm not making this up. This is a manuscript extract over it, sitting in the Bodleian Library, called Junius 11, don't worry about that. So there's our little eth, th. There's our thorn, there's our ash, and there's the win. Anyone see any words there they recognise? Good, yeah. C-A-I-N, and then there's this, looks like a seven, it just means and. A-B-E-L, Cain and Abel. So you might get their mom and dad somewhere. A-D-A-M-E-S, funny S, Adamus and Evan. Eve, E-U-A-N. And there is Adam with his little handbag and Eve about to go off and do their shopping from Eden Superstores. Okay, so we've answered quite a few. And now coming to the denouement. Why is this all so important? Because you may be thinking, well, this is fascinating stuff, but this isn't literature, this isn't anything which is at all important to me whatsoever. Of course, I'm sure you're not. But just in case there's one or two doubters in there, let's go on. Why is Old English so important? Because it is. I've just told you so, so you could take it from that. And the fact that it's on the English syllabus here, and you probably will end up doing it, or if you don't do it next term, you might do it in the third year. But that's not sufficient reason, I suppose. God, I'm technical, aren't I? Right, this is a Wordle. So what I did here, this is what's it called. I took the chapter from a very good book you should get hold of, Cambridge Companion to Old English Literature, the first chapter, Anglo-Saxon Society and its Literature by Patrick Wormald, and I chucked it in and I thought, well, what words come up? Do these mean it? Well, obviously we've got literature, we've got the Anglo-Saxons, then we've got things like London, Beowulf, things we'd expect, but kings here, Christian, laws, Bede, people like that, Christianity, kingdom, European, warrior, heroic, etc., political. So the things that we talk about in the Anglo-Saxon period, although there are some names and terminologies which are perhaps not familiar or have died out or whatever, but a lot of them, the ideas, what's the background, is important to modern-day culture. Shows us where English comes from and how it relates to other languages, and we'll talk about that more next week. Also tells us about the history, the society, and the geography of England. This is 500 years of English history, or British history if you want. Before this, there was no concept of a land called England. After it, of course, there was. There is a language called English. And also the geography of England. It was a well-structured society, particularly by the end. So we had Anyone want to guess how that's pronounced? Shire, exactly. We had shires. Most of the shires that we now talk about were around in the 8th century. And you would name the shire after the county town, the main town, which is where the royal person used to live. So, Hamptonshire. Hampton is actually, it's the Southampton, because they had to distinguish between a North and a Southampton. Hamptonshire is, of course, Hampshire. Wiltshire, Wiltshire. These are where these names come from. These are well-organised people. They were governed by tribal leaders and thanes, but they had administrative people. So they had shire reeves, or in the Wild West, sheriffs. But also the names tell us something, the names of places. For example, is anyone here from Birmingham? Be proud. Why is it called Birmingham? 2 years ago, someone said, because it mings. Which is not fair on Birmingham, if you've ever been. Anyone know? So why are many places called Ingham in Britain? It's kind of, well, it's not really English, but that just means the settlement, and that means the descendants. So someone like Beorm or something like that will have changed slightly. This is where the descendants of him lived. So if we have, Nottingham, for example, and so on. My favourite place, where I used to live in Essex, East London, Walthamstow, which means the welcoming place, which is kind of ironic if you've ever been to Walthamstow. It's certainly anything but. But it tells us about the geography of English. It tells us about the place names. Also, we are living in medieval lands. You may not think we are, but we are. Houses of Parliament, a great Gothic monstrosity, perhaps, full of equally monstrous Goths, was designed in the Victorian Gothic Revival because they were harking back to the medieval period. And in particular, with Albert and Victoria on the throne, they were trying to harken back to a period when the Germans were nice, or they liked the Germans, back to the Anglo-Saxon period to point out their roots. And indeed, another Gothic place here is our own very Natural History Museum, and you'll see Gothic architecture around. I'll talk about that in the fifth lecture, about medievalism and how it survives and how it was important. There is also a cultural importance. I've mentioned the Staffordshire Horde. I can't spell Staffordshire there quite clearly. As we will find out, some of the great writers of English literature drew on Old English for their inspiration. Hopkins, Pound, Auden, Heaney, Jones, Hill. And I'll talk about those in probably the fifth lecture. Indeed, I will. But let us have a look at this. Okay, so a clip from Jackson's The Two Towers, the second film in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. If you have a handout, then look at the front page. If you haven't, don't worry. But think of those lines. The lines are actually spoken by Aragorn in the book, but that's by the by. They're pretty much a paraphrase of an Anglo-Saxon poem called The Wanderer, which is a quite stunning poem. It really is. It talks about a person who's been exiled and is musing on their fate, and talks about, at one point in particular, the passing of worldly glory. It is a poem which means a lot to many people, and particularly as you get older. There's a translation from it. I'll read that out. Where has gone the steed? Where has gone the man? Where has gone the giver of treasure? Where has gone the place of the banquets? Where are the pleasures of the hall? Alas, the gleaming chalice. Alas, the armoured warrior. Alas, the majesty of the prince. Truly that time has passed away, has grown dark under the helm of night, as though it had never been. Or in the Old English, where quam meag, where quam mago, where quam madum gifa, where quam simla yesetu, where sindon sela de reamus, eala beocht buna, eala bernwiga, eala theodnus thrim, who seo thragiwat yenap under nicht helm, swa heo newara. Now, I'm not expecting you to translate it, but you can go away and match those two things there. But the interesting thing, of course, is why did Tolkien include some lines from an Anglo-Saxon poem in his great book of the 20th century? The reason, as I'm sure you know, is that Tolkien taught Old English at Oxford University and Middle English and to occasionally Old Norse. And that book and his mythology is infused with all the stories and all the texts that he read and enjoyed and taught. And in this particular instance, those people there, which Bernard Hill was leading, the Rohirrim, are pretty much his idea or a depiction of the Anglo-Saxons. Now, regardless of what you think of J.R.R. Tolkien or his books, you may think they're the biggest load of rot ever written. What you have to recognise is that a book which draws heavily on medieval literature, and in this particular instance on Old English literature, did rather well in the 20th century and is still doing very well, and those films have done well. So it hits a cultural chord. I don't know why, I don't know what, but it does. So to dismiss Old English, even if you forget Tolkien, but remember Auden, remember Heaney, remember Hill, remember Jones, etc., is to dismiss quite a big swathe of modern literature. So it is culturally important. Okay, in summary, Old English is the language and literature of the Anglo-Saxons, which you probably knew. Anglo-Saxons ruled England from around 450 AD to the Norman conquest. Old English is directly related to modern English. Many of our words come from Old English. I hope I've demonstrated that to a certain degree. It was an oral culture with some runic inscriptions, but then it moves to a literate culture using an alphabet, writing on manuscripts, and we'll talk about them a bit later. Not today, in other lectures. And it is culturally important, honestly. But in case you want to come away with something completely useful for this, here's a few things you can go down the pub and say. I recommend the Eagle and Child, because I know the barman. Twa beoras, three beoras, feor beoras, two beers, three beers, four beers. I couldn't work gin and tonic, but anyway, you can do it. Chwat thin gangpit is broken. Gangpit is a pit you go on, so basically your toilet's knackered. If you see someone you like, cumas thu here oft, I'm sure you can work that one out. What is thin ferinder rim? Ferinder is a mobile or going. Rim is a number, so what's your mobile number? And if it gets a bit leery, oot nu, which means outside now. Okay. So, if you are being set any translation exercises, 4 o'clock next Wednesday, and then there's a second one following on. Basic introduction to grammar and how to struggle with Old English. But if you've done German or whatever, don't worry, it's probably very basic for you. Handouts, ask any questions. What I would like you to do, if you get a chance, go and find a poem called The Rune in translation. Don't read it in the Old English for next time. What we're going to be doing next week is language. Why do we say hound? The Germans say hund, but the French chien. And things like that. Why do we use apostrophes in a phrase like the girl's car? Why do people from the north say nout and out? And much, much more. Thank you. I hope I see you next week.